And they do. And they, I mean, professors, for instance, receive about 10 or 12 times the ordinary average wage, which, to my surprise, seemed much more adequate than I'd expected.
There's also an inequality politically, isn't there? Because you do have special posts for the Communist Party, naturally, and then for people in whom the Communists have confidence, and then a large layer of people that have no special privilege at all politically.
Well, as I understand it, I mean, Russia clearly is a dictatorship and is ruled by this small elite, the Communist Party, which is said to not number more than 2 millions in a country of 200 millions. But as far as I could see, the new privileged class are not political. I talked to the manager of the chocolate factory, well, and the farm manager. I'm a bit of a farmer. They were both technicians.
You mean privileged economically?
Economically privileged, but not politically privileged. But, of course, they owe their job to the appointment of the political machine.
Do you have the impression that anybody who is opposed to the regime in Russia might get a good job in a factory?
Of course, that was one of the things that struck me at once. There is no one opposed. Obviously, there are people who don't approve of things, but they've got so used to not saying anything about it that it's much more united behind the government, apparently at any rate, than even Hitler's Germany was behind Hitler.
What is your evidence for that statement?
That people like the committee of the Baptist Church, which, after all, has been a somewhat persecuted body, and to whom we spoke directly without interpreters some of the time. I had long talked to one of them in French.
The interpreter was present?
Yes, but it was at the other end of the room, and my conversation certainly wouldn't have been overheard until my colleagues were talking to another of them in German. Mm-hmm. And they seemed so free to talk about everything, and what I really feel is this, that this operation of the police state has been operating on a much narrower front than I'd expected, and that the ordinary people, the great mass of the people, are unconscious.
Unconscious of the
they know about it, but in sort of naive remarks, oh yes, we know about these camps, but what do you do with your political prisoners?
Now, what has been your impression of the attitude of the Russian people towards international problems, the problem of peace in particular?
Well, as you said at the outset, men and women everywhere long for peace, that goes without saying. And they're very much worked up about, inside Russia, about this peace committee. All the churches have joined up and...
Do you think there's a genuine support or an enforced support?
Oh, I think it's genuine. I think that, well, at any rate, as far as church members are concerned, they feel here is something we can all unite on. And as it's received government blessing and is in fact, probably a government-inspired movement, everyone seems to be pulling along together inside Russia.
Where do the Russians think the threat to peace comes from? I mean, what is
undoubtedly America. They think, just as we think that Russia is arming and rearming in order to be able to prosecute war, and they say in order to defend peace, so they are clear in their own minds that America wants war, or rather American business. They divide American people and American business. American business and the government, which is controlled by business, wants war for the profit it brings.
Isn't that a result of a definite effort on the part of the government to teach them that separation between the people and the government?
Yes.
And the government and the businessman?
Yes, possibly, but I think this question of American financial reports on what had happened if there was peace in Korea, an economic crisis, that was drawn to my attention very forcibly, that they are frightened of, that American business is frightened of what peace would bring in the way of an economic crisis.
Now, what is the concrete problem in the field of foreign policy which concerns the Russians most?
I found a second fear, in everyone's mind of a rearming of Western Germany. They're probably ignorant about anything in Eastern Germany. This is the ordinary people. But they're very frightened, both of a German rearmament for the reason they've had a German invasion in living memory, and secondly, they're very frightened of adding Germany's industrial potential to that of the West. They realize that wars are fought with machine tools as well as machine guns.
Of course, this is a change of attitude. At one time, they were very anxious to unite Germany because they thought it would be united under Russia. Now that it looks as if union might take place under the West, they're rather in favor of some kind of a peaceful arrangement before union.
That seems to me the most hopeful possibility in the way of some real diplomatic horse trading. If We want to stop Russia arming Eastern Germany, and they want to stop us arming Western Germany, and the German people, above all things, want a united, free Germany, a really free Germany. It seems to me you've got the ingredients of a possible negotiation. You see, I don't think we shall get very far by speeches. I think we've got to find actual stepping stones that will let the world's temperature down.
In other words, what you would advocate is the neutralization of Germany.
That's what I want to see.
Of course, the great concern in this country is how are you going to enforce neutralization? How do you guarantee that a neutralized Germany stays neutralized?
Yeah, but what of the future if we have a divided, fully armed Germany? I can see in Germany a sort of North European Balkans 10 or 20 years hence.
In other words, you would be afraid that Germany would play the same role for the outbreak of the Third World War, which Serbia played for the outbreak of the First World
War.
Yes. So it would put the lighted match to the powder keg.
That's it. And I believe a divided Germany is a very dangerous thing.
Well, one of the things that happened when Germany became united was that Germany became belligerent. I think you could build an argument from historical experience that a divided Germany is a measure of peace, a guarantee of peace, a loose area, a kind of no man's land between the belligerent powers in the West and the belligerent powers in the East. I don't care to make that argument at the present time. What I'd like to raise is the question of supposing we agree that it would be highly desirable to have some kind of negotiations over Germany between the East and West, between Russia and the United States especially. How in the world can we get them to sit down and talk about it?
Well, I've always found in negotiation that if you know something the other fellow wants, it's a good start, because if you go into negotiations only knowing what you want, you're boxing blind.
But they've been negotiating in Korea now for 8 months or more or less, and each knows what the other wants, and each seems to be ready to make very slow concessions to the other, but the concessions are so slow it doesn't give any encouragement to believe that they'd succeed any better in Germany.
I was going to say, isn't that an example that when you actually start fighting, it's extraordinarily difficult to get any area of agreement? I'm so desperately anxious to get, as I think I used the phrase just now, get the temperature of the world down a bit. I don't think we're going to have any easy shortcut to a better understanding in the world.
Of course, there is another problem concerning negotiations, and that is that what the one side very badly wants is unacceptable to the other side. Take, for instance, Napoleon or Hitler. You couldn't have negotiated with either of them, because what they wanted was a domination of the world.
Yes.
Now it might well be that the Soviet rulers want also the domination of the world.
Well, I, of course, have no real knowledge of that, but I did see one of the men who I rely on for some of my views about Russia is the Indian ambassador to Russia, Dr. Radhakrishnan, and he doesn't think that Stalin has got Hitler's ambition in that way.
Is he a professional diplomat?
No, he's one of the world's great philosophers. He's a fellow of All Coal Souls College, Oxford.
Well, I'd be inclined to doubt myself that Stalin wanted to conquer the world, but it does seem to me that dictators generally are, having come to power by means of revolution, are likely to want to hold on to power and to be fearful that they're going to lose it. One of the ways of holding on to power is persuading your people to believe that there's a common outside enemy. Mm-hmm. I don't think he wants to make conquests, or at least not of the world, but I do think that he wants to keep a sense of uneasiness going inside of Russia, and therefore he is not anxious for peace.
Oh, I think that I accept the point that Russia has come to power by force, and that on her perimeter, at any rate, forces has and is being used all over the place. But Radhakrishnan's point is that the real interest in Russia is the progress economically, which is quite significant.
Well, Cadbury, your account of your experience, of course, is extremely interesting, and to a very considerable extent they correspond with my very much earlier experiences that are certainly out of date by this time. I think you've made a splendid effort to give us a well-balanced and impartial account of your observations. It will not surprise you, however, I'm sure, if I still entertain some doubts as to the total validity of some of your remarks.
Well, because I start with the view that I've got a religious urge to try and get peace. And until we've got all the frontiers of the world as safe as the frontier between the United States and Canada, 3,000 miles without a soldier, we shan't be free from the fear of war. We've got to keep that ideal continuously in front of us.
Well, Gottschalk and Cutbury, I think we are all agreed how immensely important it is for a private group of men to go to an alien, strange, and hostile country and to see for themselves, as far as they can, what it is all about. Generally, the information we get about the Soviet Union comes either from diplomats or from communists or fellow travelers or from escaped communists. That is to say, generally, from people who have either an axe to grind or are limited in their expressions of opinion by their official status. I think if the Quaker mission to Moscow of 1951 has achieved nothing but to lift for a moment the Iron Curtain and to allow us to take a glimpse into the unknown territory of the Soviet Union, it has achieved a very great deal.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's roundtable were Paul A. Cadbury, Vice President of Cadbury Brothers Limited, Birmingham, England, Louis Gottschalk, historian, and Hans J. Morgenthau, Director of the Center for the Study of American Foreign Policy, both of the University of Chicago. We wish to remind you that today's roundtable was the second of two roundtables giving first-hand reports of present conditions inside the Soviet Union. Last week, the distinguished German churchman, Pastor Martin Niemöller, presented his views of Russia today. For 20 cents in coin, you may order printed pamphlets of both discussions. These two roundtable pamphlets contain the views of Dr. Cadbury and of Pastor Niemöller and additional materials on Russia today. Enclose 20 cents and address the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3 a year, you may also subscribe regularly to the roundtable pamphlet. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.